This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Today, we're talking about habits and addictions. Later this hour, legislation aimed at curbing our state's dependence on fossil fuels. And for sports fans in the throes of March Madness, we've got some lighthearted sports science. But mostly, we're talking about an addiction that's on the rise in the United States, smartphones and social media. We start with the underlying neurobiology of all addictions. Judson Brewer is associate professor in medicine and psychiatry and director of research at the Center for Mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. His new book is The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. Judson Brewer joins us now by Skype. Welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks for having me.
Addiction has come to be seen as a disease, and we often talk about some people as being more prone or more vulnerable to problems with addiction than others, but you actually start the book saying that, quote, people who smoke are no different than anyone else. So is everyone equally prone to addiction? What makes the difference between some people who really struggle with addiction and those who don't?
Certainly there are genetic factors that might predispose some of us to get more addicted more easily to cigarettes or other drugs. So I think of human nature, and that this taps into a natural reward-based learning process. Some of us learn better than others, and some of us learn certain things more easily than others, whether it's using cigarettes or using smartphones.
You also say that breaking addictions is as simple as seeing patterns. If it's really a simple process, why do so many people struggle so much to change their habits?
Simple, not necessarily easy, I would say. So simple is what we've found with our research and the training that we've done. The more we do, the more we find that when we really distill it down to its essential elements, that the elements themselves are relatively simple, but not necessarily easy.
Well, let's take one that's really been in the news a lot. You've actually specialized in addiction psychiatry and done a lot of work on opioid addiction. Would you say that that kind of substance abuse addiction is the same as smoking or what a lot of us have been talking about, and we'll talk about more, technology addictions or simply kind of bad habits? Are they all fundamentally the same thing at some level?
At a deep level, they're fundamentally the same thing. So this learning system may have been set up from an evolutionary standpoint to help us remember where food is. That's important.
Definitely important to know where to get food. But how does that lead to addictive behavior?
Yeah. So if we think of – so let's break it down. The simplest version of this is trigger behavior reward. So if we see some food and we eat it and we get a signal to our brain that says, oh, calories, you know, this is good for survival – then we lay down this learning process that says, oh, remember where the food is and you can come back here and get some more. If we fast forward to modern day where food is plentiful, we don't necessarily need this all the time because there's a McDonald's on every corner. Yet this process is still at play and still at play quite a bit. So our brains start co-opting this and they say, you know, well, why don't you use this to help with stress? So when you're stressed out, why don't you eat a cupcake to feel better? And we start doing that. Or why don't you smoke a cigarette, et cetera. So this same process, this basic process is at play when we start to get co-opted to, you know, smoke cigarettes, cupcakes, use heroin, et cetera.
Do you really think the things that we've started to call addictions, at least in slang, things like technology addiction, smartphone addiction, social media addiction, what have you, are those really addictive problems? Are they really problems, or are we just using that shorthand?
So if we look at texting, for example, it's now been shown to be as dangerous as drunk driving. So if texting while driving is killing as many people as drunk driving, I would consider that a problem. There was a study that showed that with the rollout of smartphones, that emergency room visits for young children under the age of 5 increased proportionally. I would consider that a problem.
You give one example in the book of some young women at the Louvre in Paris that instead of maybe looking at the paintings, they are instead using a selfie stick and taking pictures of themselves, even though they had other people with them who could have taken the picture. What do you see as problematic in that situation?
I think that's funny because Time magazine named the selfie stick one of its top 25 inventions of the year back in 2014. To me, it's a sign of the apocalypse.
Well, I can't say that I just can't seem to get into the idea of carrying this enormous thing so that I can take a picture of myself, but I'm not sure if I would have said sign of the apocalypse.
Well, it's, and maybe that's a bit strong, but the idea here is, and there's now really nice research to back this up, that it's rewarding to talk about ourselves, to do things self-related. And I won't go into all the details, but that when you scan somebody's brain when they're self-disclosing, they activate the same reward-based learning processes as heroin, alcohol, cocaine, cigarettes.
Is the addiction there really the technology? Or you said it's the self-disclosing. It's this act of perhaps thinking about yourself and also projecting your self-image. Are we just addicted to ourselves, or are we actually addicted to the technology?
I think the technology enables the addiction. So there are elements of technology. For example, we can talk about ourselves. We can gossip, which also is juicy. We can distract ourselves whenever we want. So if we're feeling bored and at a stoplight, we can pull up our phone and check Facebook, for example, as compared to like just sitting at the stoplight for 30 seconds. So there are a lot of elements where technology enables this, including intermittent reinforcement, where we never know when we're going to get that next text or that next tweet or that next like on Facebook. So it keeps us coming back for more.
It's that suspense and the FOMO, the fear of missing out, that we always want to know when's that next hit coming.
That's part of it, yes.
I can see how the evolutionary origins of looking for food and getting a reward when you've found the food, kind of, I can see how that would work. Where does boredom come into that?
If you think of boredom from an evolutionary perspective, so food tastes good, you know, we eat more of it, that's positive reinforcement, right? Also, when things are unpleasant, we want them to go away. So that's negative reinforcement. It's the same learning pathway. Does boredom feel pleasant or unpleasant?
I guess it feels unpleasant to most of us.
Yeah, I would say in general, if somebody had to pick, because there's a restless quality to it, like, oh, I'm bored, you know, like I need to find something to do. Our brains are looking for something that's more interesting. That's where, you know, if you think of boredom, we're looking for something more exciting to do. So that boredom piece actually stimulates us and says, do something, you know, make me feel good, entertain me.
And that's what we can get out of our technology.
Yes.
There's an addiction that you talk about in the book that might be surprising, and it's addiction to love. I mean, of course, we're all looking for love, for the love of our life. How is that a problem?
So I think there, and I'll speak partly from my own experience, I found that it was really, when I was in college, the excitement of romance was like being on a cocaine binge, right? I can get hits of excitement when I thought about my girlfriend, you know, when's the next time I'm going to see her? When's the next time I'm going to get a kiss? You know, I can even fantasize into the future. Oh, and we're going to live happily ever after. You know, I can already plan to our retirement before I'm even married. So there can be a quality of romance in particular, especially the early stage in romance, this infatuation stage, that it's as if we're on drugs. You know, we can think of colleagues or ourselves when we're in a new romantic relationship. You know, we're not getting our work done. We're distracted. When we're not with the person, it's as if we're going through withdrawal. You know, we're annoying to our colleagues because we're constantly talking, you know, thinking about and talking about that significant other. So you can see all of the elements of the addictive process, even the diagnostic, you know, the diagnostic values for addiction all come to play here.
That's a process, though, that for the vast majority of us, it wears off over time. It's not something that lasts forever. So does that really fit the same mold as these other addictions and the kind of pathological addiction that we've been talking about?
I think like many things, so with certain, let's say, behavioral things that we get excited about, we might get excited about a video game and then it wears off over time. Some people continue playing that video game and become more and more obsessed with it. And I think there can be, for the majority of us, thankfully, you know, the excitement of the romance kind of gives way to more stable, you know, love, let's say. Yet some people can become obsessed with relationships where, you know, they're constantly like worrying whether their partner is going to do something or they're, you know, so there can be a quality of being caught up in that relationship that persists Whereas for the majority of the population, that kind of that moves into a more stable relationship.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with neurobiologist Judson Brewer about his newest book, The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. So especially if we're talking about something as omnipresent as romantic relationships or smartphones at this point, it's really important to distinguish between this is something most of us do and maybe it's a habit versus this is a problematic addiction. And you actually have this 11-point quiz, which we're going to post on our website so folks can take it for themselves. But what are some of the questions that we should all be asking ourselves if we're wondering if our behaviors are still in the healthy realm or if they're moving into the unhealthy realm?
Right. And this checklist comes from the Diagnostic Statistics Manual 5, so the DSM-5, which is kind of the psychiatric Bible for taking symptoms and trying to determine whether somebody falls into a certain category. There certainly it's not perfect, but it's a way that we can, you know, start to work clinically. So, for example, having a craving for, you know, so whether it's our cell phone or our significant other, or, you know, getting likes on Facebook, you know, do we have a craving for whatever it is? Are we consistently thinking about using whatever X is? Are we withdrawing from or going through withdrawal if we are not, you know, able to use whatever? Is it affecting our relationships, whether it's family, whether it's social, whether it's work obligations? So those are some examples where we can start to see. We can just go through this checklist for ourselves. Is this affecting my life in a way that's not helpful?
Mindfulness is a tool that you talk about being a way to try to break addiction. So how can mindfulness, which has become this buzzword everywhere, how can it help with addictive behaviors?
You know, I've even moved away from the word mindfulness a little bit because it's a concept. And like you're saying, it's become this buzzword and it can mean many things for many different people. If we bring it to the experiential level, we can think of this in terms of awareness. So if we bring awareness to what's happening, and if those positive and negative reinforcement loops, so if there's something pleasant and we want to hold on to it and we have this urge to make that continue, or we have this unpleasantness and we have this urge to make that go away, that push and pull with the pleasant and unpleasant is an unsteady, you know, has a restless driving quality to it. That's what addiction is. It's driven, you know, driven behavior. So here, if we can bring awareness to the process itself, it helps us step out and not be driven by it. You know, we talk about having the ability to respond to a situation rather than habitually react to it. Does that make sense?
It sounds a lot like another version of kind of mindfulness training. If you're angry, you know, the stop and take 3 deep breaths before you actually respond, recognize that you're angry and that you don't have to act on that anger in an impulsive way. So kind of the same thing, recognize that you're craving and that you don't have to act on that craving in an impulsive way.
Absolutely. And I would add one piece to that. The other thing we can do is as we're acting impulsively, we can pay attention to what we get from it because this is all reward-based learning. So it's based on rewards. Well, if our brain has learned a reward to be a certain thing and we don't go back and check to say, is that really rewarding? We're just going to keep doing it habitually. But if we check back in and say, is that really that rewarding for me? It might help us change the behavior. I'll give you an example. With our smoking program, we encourage people to smoke and we say, just go ahead and smoke, but pay attention as you do. And they get this wide-eyed wonder, like, where did I not notice this before? Because they start to realize that their cigarettes don't taste that good.
But there's still got to be some reward there that was driving the cravings and the addiction in the first place. What's the reward for not doing it?
What's the reward for not smoking?
Yeah, what's the reward, you know, if you notice that Facebook is a problem and you always want likes, what's the reward if you don't go on Facebook and you don't get likes?
Yeah. So the first thing that we can – I love the Facebook example. The first thing we can look at is what's it actually feel like when I get likes? You know, it's this restless, excited quality that wears off quickly. And then we're like, where's my next like? I need another like. So we can ask ourselves, how good is that compared to, you know, the peace and joy that comes from like not being addicted to Facebook?
You're talking about mindfulness in the context or this awareness in the context of trying to break bad habits or addictive behaviors. Can it be used to prevent addictive behaviors?
That's a great question. I think it absolutely can be, because the more we, so let's say if we're changing an old habit from habitually reacting on autopilot to, you know, whenever some stressful situation comes up, we become more curious about it. So curiosity, curious awareness is really what mindfulness is about. Curiosity in itself feels pretty good, right? Curiosity as compared to this craving that I have to do something. So if we can move into that realm of curiosity and start to train that as our new habit, I don't know anybody that has gotten harmed from paying attention more to something, right? So this might be a good habit to develop. As we develop it, we can start to see when we might be pulled into the direction of new habits or new addictions that might pull us off base or get us into these loops that are more restless and driven than as compared to just, you know, just being with whatever is, if that makes sense.
Would it be possible to get addicted to mindfulness?
It's a great question. In the ancient psychology, they talk about it, the craving to end all craving. So the idea there may be that, you know, if we can really see the reward that comes from paying attention, that can drive us to pay attention so much that we don't get sucked into any type of craving. It's possible.
So how could people, if they're interested in trying this kind of awareness or mindfulness, how could people get started in their daily lives?
There are many ways that people can get started. So obviously there are many books that are written about the nuts and bolts of, you know, how to start practicing mindfulness. There's a great one that's free actually on the web called Mindfulness in Plain English. That's a good starter manual. I read that one 3 times, but there are tons and tons of books out there. There are also courses that people can take here at the Center for Mindfulness. You know, this is where mindfulness-based stress reduction was first birthed about 35 years ago. And there are MBSR courses all over the world now that people can take. And now in the modern technology, people are starting to develop apps to help train mindfulness.
I was going to ask you about the irony of mindfulness-based apps.
Yeah. So there are a lot of people are getting into the fray, you know, just giving basic, you know, meditation practices. We've taken a more evidence-based approach where we take pain points specifically, you know, if somebody is smoking, you know, we developed an app called Craving to Quit that helps them start to overcome smoking. Even if people are stress or emotional eating, we use that as a pain point. So if somebody has pain, they're motivated to try something. So we can bake in all of the science and all of the experience that we have with the mindfulness trainings that we've developed right into that. That app's called Eat Right Now. So there are, you know, there are basic, you know, sit down and take a breath meditation apps, and there are more, you know, ones that are more mechanistically based, like the Craving to Quit and Eat Right Now.
Neurobiologist Judson Brewer of UMass Medical School joined us by Skype. His new book is The Craving Mind: From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. Judson Brewer, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll hear from a psychologist helping people with internet addictions when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. It can be hard to believe that a piece of software can hold the same power over us as a chemical like heroin. And yet, that is the reality for a growing number of Americans. An estimated 72% of adults in the United States own a smartphone. Those devices make our lives easier, undoubtedly, from coordinating who's picking up the kids to being able to look up a fact you need just a few minutes before a presentation. But there's increasing evidence that we would be better off setting some limits for ourselves when it comes to our smartphones. Joining us now by Skype to review some of the latest studies on smartphones and other technology is Dr. Saul Rosenthal. He's a clinical health psychologist from Newton, Massachusetts. And about 12 years ago, he saw his first patient with an internet addiction. Since then, he's seen many more. Saul Rosenthal, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you so much for inviting me on, Heather.
Now, we should say up front that psychologists like you are not saying that we all need to just throw our smartphones away and be done with them. There's maybe a little bit of good news here. At least one study has found a benefit actually to using Facebook. So what's that about?
Well, yeah, first, I definitely want to echo what you said. We are not trying to get rid of technology. In fact, many of us love technology, and I consider myself one of those. I use a lot of technology in my practice, in fact. And there are studies that show heavy technology users can benefit. So the study that you're alluding to, it's a Facebook study that showed that people who are heavy users of Facebook are also less depressed than people who are less involved with social media.
I mean, is that maybe just a version of people who have a bigger social network, more social interaction, tend to be happier and healthier on a mental level?
It probably is the case that larger social networks are related to healthier outcomes. So that's certainly part of it. I think that if you look across the studies, another piece of it is the active user versus the passive consumer. So studies that show benefit also tend to show that the individuals who benefit the most are the ones that are creating content, they're posting, they're really engaged in a proactive way. Whereas those individuals who are much more passive, just sort of consuming, tend to be more likely to be depressed or anxious.
So don't be a Facebook troll and just hang out there and watch everybody else. If you're going to do it, actually do it.
Yeah, do it and do things that are useful and more pro-social.
All right. So unfortunately, there are a lot more studies that find being glued to our smartphones and even hooked into social media can be bad for us. So what's some of the evidence that our smartphones are making us less productive and less happy?
Yeah, well, it's definitely true that most of the research and certainly headlines do tend to focus on the negative aspects of technology use. But there are a lot of health concerns. I think the most well-studied or the best evidence we have is the impact that technology use has on sleep. And it's not just staying up all night and engaging with social media, although that is a piece of it. It seems to be engaging with the technology itself, and it may have something to do with the frequency of the light that's put out by particularly smartphones or the brightness of the light. But there's a number of studies that show that using that can really have an impact on sleep. It reduces melatonin production, which, as you may know, helps us go to sleep. It also seems to make the sleep we have a lower quality. So there's a lot of evidence about sleep, and that's a big issue in a lot of health concerns. But there's a lot of other studies showing all kinds of physical, psychological, and social impact. And a lot of this is even relatively normal. I mean, I think most people out there have said, I'm going to spend 15 minutes checking my email, and 3 hours later you're watching cat videos on YouTube.
Okay, that's guilty as charged, definitely.
Yeah, that's a lot of lost productivity time. And there's some estimates that at work, about a third of internet use at work is actually not work-related. So a lot of productivity issues. There are certainly a lot of problems with overusing in terms of are people overusing to manage anxiety or manage depression? Works in the short term, makes depression and anxiety worse in the long term. So there are studies showing that the more people use, in fact, the more distressed they get, even though they think they're using to feel better. So that can be a pretty serious psychological issue, and there are a lot of physical health problems as well.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with clinical health psychologist Saul Rosenthal about healthy and unhealthy smartphone habits. Now, the cover story in the March issue of the Journal of the American Psychological Association is all about taking back control from our smartphones. They've come up with a list of things that we can do to minimize the pitfalls of using our smartphones too much. So what were some of those recommendations?
Sure. In general, the recommendations kind of come down to moderation and conscious choices. And they kind of fall into four categories. So first, don't use your smartphone for everything. Just use it for what's important and what you can't do otherwise. So for example, if you're taking notes in class or recording lectures, if you take notes, if you write them, as research shows that writing notes, you will learn the information better than if you type them. The same is true with reading. You get more out of a book if you read an actual physical book versus a virtual book.
And do we know why that is? I mean, is that, again, coming back to the light on the screen or the fact that we can click away? I've wondered that a lot because I do read a lot on technology devices, whether it's a Kindle or, you know, whether it's backlit or not. I do read on technology a lot.
Sure, and you know, I do as well, and I even take notes using my laptop or iPad. But I think, and it hasn't been studied well, but I think it's probably the way we are engaging with the material is probably at a deeper level. You kind of have to work harder in some ways when you're reading or writing using physical instruments. And I think that that work itself probably helps encode the information more effectively. So choosing what to do with your technology is really important. A second recommendation from that article is deciding, and again, consciously deciding how you often or how much you're going to be connected. It's very easy for us to be connected 24/7, and there's a lot of reinforcement of that. But it takes a huge physical and psychological toll. If we're connected all the time, we start to perceive the information we get as much more important than it is. So every notification, every ding, every email becomes vitally important if we're on all the time. So turn the notifications off. Don't constantly check your email, but maybe check it 3 times a day. Now that can sound impossible to many people, and so it probably makes sense to start cutting down slowly. So maybe give yourself 15 extra minutes a week of offline time and expand that. And then you have people who kind of expect you to be on all the time, and you need to think about how much control you want other people or the technology itself to have.
As you were saying, in a lot of cases, this is almost a work expectation. We feel like in order to do our jobs or be perceived as doing our jobs, we need to be on all the time. So there were actually some recommendations about talk to people, whether
right.
it's, you know, family or your boss or whoever, about what they expect and maybe what they should be expecting of you in terms of your connectedness.
That's often true. And you may have to talk with specific people, but there is also a general expectation that we are on all the time. You see that often with adolescents in particular, where they believe, rightly or wrongly, that all of their friends are on all the time and that they are expected to be on all the time. And so they're going to bed with their smartphones and not really sleeping very well because either they are engaged in social media or they're expecting to hear from friends. So part of it is, as you say, setting up the expectations with specific people, whether they're bosses or family members. But also part of it is developing our own expectations and sticking with those.
All right. So we've got still one or two more recommendations, right?
Yeah. So one is that, and again, we alluded to this before, which is to, when you engage in online materials, be a content creator, not just a consumer. That people who really actively use social media or create content for Wikipedia or whatever, or have a blog, they actually tend to be healthier and less stressed than passive users. Finally, related to that, you've got to protect your health. So obviously, you don't want to use your phone when you're driving. We have thousands of accidents because of distracted driving, and thousands of people killed every year. And again, as I suggested before, sleep is a really, really significant issue with technology use. And it's really important to protect sleep. And it's also important to recognize how much of an impact that technology has on sleep. And in fact, it's such a serious issue that when I work with families or individuals, that's kind of a rule that I insist on, regardless of anything else, is that they keep the technology out of the bedroom.
Clearly, almost all of us could improve our smartphone use, our smartphone habits, but most of us are not actually addicted to our smartphones or the internet in a way that looks like an addiction to a chemical like heroin. You've treated people who have slid across that line into addiction. What does that look like?
Yeah. First, I think it's important to realize that most people are not addicted to the internet or to their phones.
Even though we all tend to say that all the time.
Right. We say it a lot. But that's kind of like saying an alcoholic is addicted to the bottle. Technology, it's the way a person may access whatever it is they are addicted to. And most often, though not exclusively, online it tends to be pornography or gaming. And so people that I work with who are addicted to those things, they do look very much like individuals who might be addicted to a substance like alcohol or heroin. you know, they often lie about their usage. They may try unsuccessfully to cut back. They need more and more to get the same experience or the same feeling. And they continue to use even as their lives are falling apart. It's a particularly difficult to treat true addictions to technology, partly because we don't really know what works best. It hasn't been studied very well. Traditional addiction treatments really aren't practical because, unlike heroin, you can't really live without technology. We really need to train people or relearn how to use technology in a healthy way. So it's much more like treating an eating disorder, where I work with individuals or families to help the person develop a healthier relationship with the technology rather than give it up entirely. And so part of it is structural change, you know, learn to use the technology correctly. And that may mean things like software blocks to particular sites, although those are always easy to get around, or, you know, deleting accounts on gaming accounts, for example. So part of it is learning how to use it more appropriately. Part of it is learning how not to need the high or the distraction you get. And so I do a lot of work with mindfulness, for example, or we need to focus on other issues like the anxiety or depression or attention deficit. And then in an ongoing way, it's really about reducing the likelihood of harm. So how do you use the technology without going too far in the other direction? You know, it's almost like how can you help an alcoholic work in a bar without slipping? So when I'm working with people who would meet criteria for addiction, it's pretty tough. But in fact, a lot of the people I work with, they're having problems, but they don't really fit into the criteria of addict.
In what way?
Well, they may be having other issues. And in fact, you know, the term internet addiction, it's a bit controversial, although sometimes I think it's more controversial to suggest it does not exist or that people aren't addicted. But we really don't know if technology overuse is an addiction. There are a few studies out, but the data are really mixed. So there are some, for example, brain imaging studies that look at the reward centers of the brain. And this would be particularly for heavy gamers. And the reward centers of their brain do look similar to the reward centers of substance abusers in that they're not efficient. The reward systems don't work efficiently. And so that outside substance, whether it's heroin or alcohol or gaming, sort of gets the reward system to activate. So it's almost like they need that external stimulus to reward themselves. There's not a lot of self-reward going on. So there are some studies showing that there's similarities there. But on the other hand, there are studies showing that heavy gamers actually have some stronger cognitive skills than non-gamers. So they may have better response time. They're better at certain cognitive tasks.
I remember seeing something years ago that people who played some of the most violent, fast-paced shoot-'em-up games actually had more advanced math skills in some cases. Weird connections.
There are, and if you think about it, it's a skill that's necessary for the gaming. So the gaming actually does require skill, whereas substance abuse, I don't think you could argue that a heavy heroin user has any cognitive advantage over light heroin users. And in fact, you know, obviously we use technology for a lot of good, and heavy technology for a lot of good. There are, for example, curriculums based on the world-building game Minecraft that are designed for kids with autism that are effective. So there are ways in which we use a lot of technology for good. It can cause problems, and that's obviously an issue. But I think simply looking at heavy usage as addiction is very limiting and problematic. We've all sort of overused. That doesn't make all of us addicts.
That's Saul Rosenthal. He's a clinical health psychologist from Newton, Massachusetts, who's been treating people with internet addictions for more than a decade. He joined us by Skype. Saul Rosenthal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And don't forget, if you're wondering how your smartphone and social media habits stack up, take our quiz. It's on our website, capeandisland.org. Up next, sports phenomena you've always wondered about, explained in a new book. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break.